Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. Was brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, heritagefoodsusa.com, heritageradionetwork.org.
Pleasure.
You won't find a recipe for it, your guests won't ask for it, you can't buy it, and you wouldn't know what to do with one if you could. But in the spirit of utilizing the whole animal this Thanksgiving, let's talk a little bit about a turkey's caruncle, the hideous red fleshy pack of protuberances hanging off of a turkey's head. You'll see it depicted most in seasonal clip art as a blossoming red regalia or a little bun seductively tossed to the side of the nose, like Roger Rabbit's girlfriend's sideswept hair. These two better parts of the caruncle are the snood, the part that hangs down the nose, and the wattle, the catch-all for everything under the chin. Let's delve further into this game bird's iconic mass of extra culinary flesh and then be done with it for good, shall we? The snood is a flashy, erectile flap of skin that hangs from every turkey's forehead, though it is used mainly for males doing what they do best, which is fighting and mating. In a fight, it's the first thing to go by way of an attacking bird's pecking and pulling. It's because of this that most domesticated turkeys have their snoods lobbed off when they're young. When a turkey is on the prowl, his snood engorges with blood, doubles in length, serving as a throbbing, battle-scarred badge of virility and good health, recognized with reverence by females and other males. The name for the wattle appeared out of nowhere in the 16th century, as a more bird-centric and onomatopoeic term than the more general dewlap, referring to any fleshy or fatty under-chin protuberance. Serving the same general purpose as the snood, the wattle is known to brighten in red color when the bird is hunting for a mate. From the freer-flowing neck flaps to the bulging lower neck lobes called the major caruncles, the wattle is like a flag flowing in celebration of the turkey's 45 million years of evolution. Some of these oozing caruncles actually seem to have been spilling down a turkey's neck for about that long. While deboned turkey and goosenecks have been used as a thick and crisp sausage casing in some cuisines, this reporter has found no worthwhile culinary application for the wattle. So indulge in a Google image search, be done with the thing, and have a happy, de-snooted Thanksgiving. I'm Peter Henry for HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
That was good.
That was interesting. Well, welcome to the main course. My name is Patrick Martins. I am your host, and we're going to have a great show today. We have Emily Crumble Drake, which I remember because it reminds me of Emily Crumble Cake. She is going to be with us from Emory University, and then one of our favorite people in the food world and the first ever evolutionary of our, which is our very successful series now, which is talking about Coleman Andrews in this episode, the current one, but the very first one was Steve Jenkins, food expert, one of the founders of Dean and DeLuca and Fairway Market. We'll go on and on, but we wealth of stuff to talk about with him. But we're very excited. We just processed all these turkeys, and we are knee-deep in turkeys, and the fridges are filled with heritage turkeys, including a Fairway Market. So we are happy to be sitting down, take a little break, and be in the radio studio at Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street. Our first guest is Emily Crumble Drake, who works with Emory University, and we are very proud of a 4 or 5 year history of them buying heritage turkeys every Thanksgiving for the entire campus. So it is really one of the largest institutional support purchases for heritage breeds. So, Emily, are you with us on the phone?
I am, Patrick.
Oh, well, thanks so much for taking some time out of your Sunday to be with us.
No problem. And it's actually Cumby Drake, although I kind of like the Crumble Drake.
Well, that's not as good now. No, it's just that's still a very good name. Well, tell us exactly what you do at Emory, your role there, and then tell us about this event that's been happening for the past 5 years with the turkeys and how that looks on campus.
Yeah, well, I am a sustainability program coordinator in Emory's Office of Sustainability Initiatives, and I also spend a portion of my time working with Emory Dining on both sustainable food education and some of their waste management efforts. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually an Emory alum. I graduated from the college in 2010, and this past Thursday we had our, I think it's our sixth annual, actually, Heritage Harvest Feast on campus. Where we purchased over 700 pounds of heritage turkeys from Heritage Foods USA, and we served them in our main student dining facility as well as the faculty dining room and one of the cafes at the School of Public Health. And we served them along with a seasonal menu of some roasted sweet potatoes and simmered greens and a fall succotash, some good local Southern style food. And I worked with students. I'm the advisor for the Slow Food Emory student group and serve on the board of Slow Food Atlanta. And so we had some of the Slow Food students actually in the dining facility as students were lining up to get their turkey, working to educate them about what's special about these turkeys. We had a student, I convinced a student to dress up in a turkey costume this year, which was really fun. And we only had a few seconds, probably 10 or 20 seconds to chat with students as they were getting in line for their turkey. But we tried to discuss with them the importance of preserving diversity within our food system and just get at the simple fact that in order to save these animals, we need to eat them. Mm-hmm. So we handed out stickers to students who were eating the food saying, "I eat them to save them," with a link to Heritage Foods USA's website. Mm-hmm. And we also have some seasonal food guides, which we handed out to students. We're finding that more and more students are really unaware of what's seasonality in Georgia and why it's important. And so we incorporated that into the education effort.
Because it's nice there all the time. Everyone figures everything is available year-round. Now, tell me, obviously this is part of a larger initiative by Emory University to bring more sustainable dining options onto campus. So could you speak to the other things you do throughout the year?
Yeah, well, Emory University has, to my knowledge, the most aggressive sustainable food purchasing goal in the country at any university. It's a goal of 75% local or sustainable food by 2015. And so we're working to achieve that goal in various ways. One of our biggest successes is a farmer's market that we have every Tuesday afternoon while school's in session, which allows both students, faculty, and staff, as well as people from the hospital, which is on our campus, to have access to local fruits and vegetables, as well as baked goods and breads and grass-fed beef and cheeses and things like that on a weekly basis. We also have another really successful annual event called our Sustainable Food Fair, which an anthropology class puts on every year, which is kind of a massive farmer's market where local restaurants come in that serve local food and give out samples, and we have different organizations like Georgia Organics and Slow Food who come and educate students about the work they're doing. And at that, we incorporate some education about biodiversity as well. We always have an education table about apples and how we've really decreased our diversity of apples throughout the world in the past century. And then we, in terms of actual food purchasing, to work towards that 75% goal, we've developed a really good relationship with White Oak Pastures.
Will Harris's beef, right? He does beef, he does poultry, he's really does ducks and geese, he does a little bit of everything.
Yeah, they have some pigs now as well, and they're in South Georgia, Southwest Georgia, and Bluffton, Georgia. And so we actually, any day of the week, you can buy a grass-fed beef burger in our main food court dining facility. So that's another great example of a true success story in providing access to some really great sustainable food on campus.
Does that mean you have to deal with a lot more purveyors, I imagine, right? I mean, you can't just buy 100% of everything from one place, right? You have to kind of diversify and make things a little bit more complicated.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that when this goal was set in 2006, there wasn't really necessarily a knowledge of if the supply of these foods were even available locally or regionally. And that's one of the biggest challenges that we face, that, you know, we're an institution with 14,000 students and just as many faculty and staff. And so we serve a lot of food, and it's a challenge to find local and sustainably sourced items at a price point that the university can meet
For all those students, for sure. Well, my last question to you is, you know, as besides the food being so good, as an alum, and I know Steve, our next guest, his daughter is an alumni of Emory. What would you tell students, high school students listening as they consider Emory University? What's your pitch for what makes Emory such a great place to learn?
Well, I had an absolutely amazing experience at Emory, and I'm thrilled to be back there as a staff member. I think it being in Atlanta is a really exciting thing. Atlanta is a budding, it has a great food scene, lots of farmers markets, lots of amazing restaurants, and so it's fun to be at a great top 20 research institution with a liberal arts focus, but in this amazing city with plenty of fun things to do and good food to eat.
Well, very good. It is lovely down there, and we are very appreciative of the relationship with Heritage, and we know our network of poultry farmers are too. It's definitely a feather in their cap that you buy their turkeys. Well, thank you so much for giving us time, and people can learn more about Emory. We'll link, of course, to their website, which everyone can find easily, but we'll link on our site as well. And Emily, thank you so much for coming on. I'm sorry that I mispronounced your middle name there, your maiden name.
Don't worry about it. Well, thank you so much for your work, Patrick. Yeah. It's a pleasure to partner with you on this.
Yes. Well, have a great day, and we're going to take a break and come back with one of our favorite guests, Steve Jenkins. Stay tuned.
You are listening to Andy's Biscuits by Pamela Royal on the heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Well, we are back on the main course. We are broadcasting live out of Roberta's. We're sponsored by Cane 5, and we very much appreciate their sponsorship. So here we are in studio with Steve Jenkins. Welcome back, Steve.
Hi, Patrick. I'm happy to be here.
So we're talking Thanksgiving. Does Fairway make any money on turkeys?
We manage to make payroll this time of year, yeah.
I imagine you sell other things, but on the turkey itself, is that a big profit center, or is that just something you have to bring in to move because everyone eats one?
We always sell turkeys at such a low margin. Yeah. They are only there to bring people in the store. No, we don't make money on turkeys, but we make money on other stuff.
What are the most profitable items for a supermarket? I mean, I've had you on so many times. Where do you make money? I know Fairway, unlike Dean and DeLuca and some of the other places you've been before, you know, really sells everything.
We are a volume business, Patrick. Mm-hmm. We make money by sheer volume. And now, I've been thinking lately how 10 years ago there were no Whole Foods, there were no Trader Joe's. There was really not that kind of competition. We competed against various neighborhood markets, but we've never had this kind of competition coming after us the way we do the last couple of years and certainly this year. So the result of that is everybody is auguring down their retail prices for everything in an attempt to make themselves look as value conscious as Fairway, mm-hmm. and it's difficult for us to not be embarrassed and to not get killed on prices of things, because a big outfit like ShopRite or Stop and Shop heretofore was not our competitor, but they are these days because we've got 14 stores and another number of stores coming. So every place we go, we're bunking up against somebody who's trying to kill us. Mm-hmm. And that being said, in Manhattan and Queens and Brooklyn, we've got Whole Foods and Trader Joe's just shooting away at us, sniping away at us. So it's really, really difficult. Good for the consumer, because everything gets lower and lower in price, and that's a long way around of answering your question. Uh-huh. We're not making a heck of a lot of money on any particular uh-huh. item or any particular group of items, because we have so much competition uh-huh. trying to make us look bad that the prices are as low as they can be.
So how many is it, number of people in the neighborhood? Like, I'm thinking about one Fairway cannibalizing another one because they're too close to each other. Yeah. How do you distance things? Is it number of people, number of blocks?
No, you don't. You don't. You just do your demographic and you find a neighborhood that would support a Fairway. And you don't look at whether you've got one nearby or not, because if you don't take that real estate, Trader Joe's or Whole Foods is going to take that real estate, and then you're really aced out. Mm-hmm. You got to understand that we're not so proud that we don't tell the truth on the radio and in print. We had our behinds handed to us in the last 6-8 years by Trader Joe and by Whole Foods, because they got to all the real estate before we did. We're comparatively mom and pop compared to those guys, and we sort of back into everything. We're not mature. We're not modern. We're as backward and as provincial as we ever were, and anything that we've accomplished, such as getting into Red Hook or getting into Pelham Manor, was just sheer blind luck, because mm-hmm. there's no method to our madness. We're a public company now, but even the guys that own the majority of the company, they're still feeling their way, and they have to listen to us. But It's just so difficult out there. There's so much competition. Mm-hmm. It's not so much fun anymore. If it wasn't for the glory of the food and my successes at getting my hands on things that other stores don't have access to out of Europe, I'd be really jaded and I'd be really cranky. Well, I'm already cranky. I'm not jaded, but I'm cranky, because it's just gotten so bloody cutthroat. And when you do all that, those new stores, Patrick, you've got to find another cadre of experienced people who can guide a bunch of inexperienced people who are working the counters and just hoping and praying that the young and experienced don't make you look like a fool and cost you money in the process. So as I say, it's just not the way it used to be, where everybody was hale and hearty and the best at what they do. When you know, because when you get bigger, it doesn't get better. Mm-hmm. It just gets tedious. And I find it all to be really tedious these days.
Tedious.
Having a bunch of stores is what a pain in the neck.
Now, when you started at Dean and DeLuca, you would, those guys, Giorgio and Joel, had set up D&D to be really a store for cooks. And that was your mandate.
You're reading my mind.
To bring the food for cooks. So it was like not a 101. And now with Fairway, you are doing things both for cooks and for everybody. So just discuss that a little bit.
You have to have all that grab and go. I mean, even that phrase annoys me, grab and go, heat and eat. All of those supermarket phrases that just are so tedious. We have to do them or we wouldn't be able to stay in business. But we are so retro. We're such dinosaurs. Fairway should be called Fairway Dinosaur Market, because we're still all about cooking. We're still about having provided a shop that's set up for people who are serious about their ingredients, who are ingredient-driven people, who know they can trust their retail food store to have the very best that it can be of any particular thing that their recipe calls for. And that's what I've been doing for 40 years, is my recipe-driven, idiot, savant attitude towards food is that, by gosh, if you don't have the technique or the know-how to execute a recipe, but you got the guts to try, the least I can do, the least Fairway can do, is provide for you the very best ingredient that recipe calls for. And we never make any allowance for, well, is that the right price? Are those Perigord walnuts that much better than those California walnuts? Well, yeah, they are, and they're more expensive. Well, are those Brittany sardines that you bring in that are called vintage sardines because they've been in the tin for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, are they really better than King Oscar that are like 79 cents a package? Well, yeah, they are. Mm-hmm. Well, how about my anchovies that come from the Catalan coast of Catalonia? Are they better than some Shaka anchovies that come from the south coast of Sicily? No. Patrick Martins, of all people, knows about anchovies and how huge a gaping gap of difference there is between serious, hand-eviscerated, hand-packed anchovy and the ordinary ones that you find on really bad pizza. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a huge difference. So I'm ingredient driven. Everything that I think about and that I deal with throughout the day, 6 and 7 days a week this time of year, is about it being the very best. And that's a great source of pride. I mean, I walk around my stores orgulloso, man, my chest sticking out because I know what I've got. Then you got somebody come through the store and do a market basket to compare the same ingredients with Trader Joe or with Whole Foods. And we may come, Fairway may come out looking like we're charging too much money. But you know, you're comparing clementines to kumquats here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My stuff is better than what they offer.
Now, have you noticed over the years an ingredient that you really were so proud of, and then back home in Europe, they have gone down? Or have you noticed other ones that were once bad that have gone up? I mean, is there
interesting question,
much
Patrick.
Change?
I've been doing this since, I've been importing this stuff direct since the mid-90s now. So that's going on 20 years now that I've been really seriously spending all my time with importing these great ingredients. And I found that I've stuck with almost every single guy that I've been working with. The brother and sister that do my horseradish in Alsace, they've been with me for 18 years now. The people that do my sauerkraut out of Champagne and Alsace, they've been with me forever and ever. All these people, my sea salt people, my on and on. I even brought a list here to show you. My beets, I bring in beets from France. You know, you can go on all you want about local.
There's nobody
more local than Fairway. I mean, all summer long, everything is local. But when that stops, you've still got to fulfill that recipe's requirements. And if you're going to stay local, you're not going to have what you want. Mm-hmm. I mean, my horseradish that I buy out of Alsace, I mean, I love Gold's horseradish. And I imagine that horseradish root comes from someplace in the lower 48, and it's perfectly fine. But my Alsatian horseradish is better. It's just better. Mm-hmm. And on, right down the line. The answer to that question is they've all stayed the same. Have I found new stuff? Sure, I found new stuff. But I'll stick with those guys for 18 years now. Watch, because these are family-run outfits, and they don't vary in quality. They only get better, better, and better, just like my olive oil people.
Now, what about packaging? When you started in the late 70s with Dean and DeLuca, and you were bringing in these things, I imagine packaging has gotten more sophisticated and just changed. I mean, is that something important? Because I know how much energy you put into signage at Fairway, and you write every sign in every Fairway. I mean, that's like 500, that's like an encyclopedia of writing. So I'm interested about packaging from these weird little places around the world.
It's the grace and the concurrent ineptitude of the way the Europeans package and label things that delights me. Very often, you'll get grace and ineptitude within the same package that's just a scintillating presentation. For instance, a half-liter bottle of an olive oil from some little outfit in the south of France will have just a spectacular eye-beater of a raised graphic a label for their olive oil. But then the copy on the label will be misspelled. It'll be practically hand-done. So while they're blowing your mind with the choices they've made for the artwork, embossed gold drips, and then the juxtaposition of the really lame provincial copy is one of the things that delights me. Mm-hmm. And it's always been that way since the early 70s that I recall. The French and the the Italians have always done spectacular label work, but now the Spaniards are doing it too, and now the Portuguese are doing it too, mm-hmm. the Belgians are doing it too, and they've taught American artisans who are producing food how to wake up and smell the coffee as regards how they present their product. So yeah, there's been a sea change in local labeling and marketing presentation as a result of how sophisticated and insouciant at the same time the Europeans are by having great art but having really lame copy that's misspelled. I mean, my harissa maker is this Orthodox Jew who lives in Paris and manufactures in Paris, and he makes a harissa for me that's of course kosher and handmade in small batches, but he's and it's just the greatest. It's like homemade harissa. It's not like something you'd squeeze from a tube. It comes from a jar. And he's so non-compos mentis, he forgot to put the word harissa on the last huge multi-palette batch of harissa I ordered from this guy. So, and he'd get me thrown in jail because he refuses to be inspected by the French FDA, and he refuses to let an American FDA guy on his plant. So I had to cut him out. And he didn't realize suddenly he's out, you know, tens of thousands of euro just because he chooses to be primitive with his marketing and his label presentation.
Right. Well, I put that same question. What about technology in terms of temperature, consistency, and preservation? And that have these ingredients gotten better because they come across the sea better? I mean, is that technology jumped? I mean,
it's not like that. It's more. It's has more to do with the specific item that we're referring to. The people that grow, peel, and grind my horseradish in Alsace, they still have the same primitive equipment that they've ever had. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, so many of my little olive oil people, and I've got 175 olive oils that I bring in direct. Most stores have maybe 3 or 14.
Yeah.
You know, I've got like 175, and I'm devoted passionately to all of them. They've changed radically, a sea change in how they produce their olive oil. It's no longer pressed. Mm-hmm. So you know, you see first cold pressing, that's a total misnomer because olive oil is not pressed anymore, and it's certainly not cold. If it was cold, you wouldn't get a single drop out of the olives. And they're not pressed. They're mulched in two revolving cylinders that are flanged in opposite directions, and that creates the mulch and separates the oil and the water and the mulch all at one time. So
this
the
is
result
a new
is
technology.
The oil is much less oxidized, and the polyphenols remain inside. So that's a technological change, but not a modernization. It's just the lights went on with the millers in the entire industry of olive oil. They've learned how to make it as good as it can possibly be, as opposed to 5, 6, 7 years ago when it was not, when it was still pressed. So things evolve, not always in a bad way. I think the more we get modern, the worse it is for our food. But sometimes there are exceptions to the rule, such as with olive oil, where logical thinking millers who are impassioned about what they're doing have a breakthrough, and it affects the entire industry. So it's not all bad, as I say, I think it is.
Right. Now, I'm just interested, you know, I was talking to you, how do olive oil and vinegar figure into your equation of being an authority on taste? I mean, that is interesting. I mean, you really excel. You're good with all these lists, and I want to see this list, but why olive oil? Is it because of how pervasive it is in so many cuisines and how much you need it, or because it was so bad before you started bringing these in? Why are you an expert in particular in these? I mean, cheese, obviously. You wrote a Bible on cheese, the cheese primer. But why olive oil and vinegar now?
It's the same thing with olive oil and vinegar as it was for me with cheese. Back in the old days, back in the mid-70s and 80s, I realized there were no decent cheeses in New York. There was no decent cheese available to New Yorkers. So I changed all that myself because nobody else did. Mm-hmm. Nobody else thought it was necessary. Everybody was happy to have all these derivatives and imitations of the real thing. So I went after the real thing, and I made it staple in New York. So many cheeses, I can't even begin to label them, name them. And Patrick, I turned around and I realized the same thing about olive oil. I learned too much too fast about olive oil. And what I learned is that nobody knows anything about olive oil. Mm-hmm. And then number two, I learned that everything that was available in New York City into the mid-90s is not worthy of anybody who's serious about food, and certainly not worthy of anyone serious about olive oil. So I made it my business to get my hands on the real deal olive oils that have been grown and milled by people who understand the nature of olive oil, as opposed to people who are in the olive oil industry who only understand how to make money out of olive oil. Mm-hmm. And when you make money out of olive oil, it means you are undoubtedly someone who left the olives on the tree too long. You waited until those olives were purple and black to where they had zero polyphenols left in them, which is the whole raison d'etre for olive oil in the first place, because it's that bitterness that brings out the flavors in foods, as well as that bitterness being the substance that will make you live forever with hardly ever any instance of disease. So everything being offered to New Yorkers as regards olive oil was not just not the right thing, it's not good for you. Mm-hmm. And if the EU was honest, the EU would tell people, we have learned through our research, and we've spent hundreds and hundreds of thousands of euros on this, we've learned that oxidized olive oil that's labeled extra virgin in every supermarket across the country is bad for you. It's not just not good.
Right.
It is bad for you. But if they told people that, it would turn a multi-hundred million dollar industry on its ear. It would throw a lot of people out of work. It would throw a lot of people in jail. Mm. And it would put a lot of people out of business. So the EU is not going to tell you, don't buy that bottle of olive oil in the supermarket that's $6.99 for a liter, because it's cheap olive oil that was derived from olives that were dead, and you've got no business using it. And if it tastes good to you, it's because your mom and dad thought it tasted good. They always had lousy olive oil. Their moms and dads think it tastes good because they always had lousy olive oil. Olive oil has got to be early harvest, preferably mono or bicultivar, meaning only one or two varieties of olives, in order to show some respect for the cultivar that is in that bottle. And it's got to have that high polyphenol level that early harvest renders to olive oil, because those are what battle the free radicals and make olive oil stay fresh and tasty and not be oxidized and not be bad for you.
Well, very interesting. One of the things, most interesting things, and I talk about this all the time, that I learned from Steve is, yeah, people didn't necessarily eat better in the good old days. You know, a lot of times people didn't eat meat as good. You know, we read The Jungle and all the muckrakers, but also with things like olive oils and tomatoes and pasta and all these things that we take for granted now. Well, we are going to take a quick break, and then we have told people that Steve was coming in, so we have some weird random questions coming up. So stay tuned for the last segment with one of our heroes, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
You are listening to Without You by Pamela Royal on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
right. Well, if anyone's listening, hopefully they're learning. I am Patrick Martins, your host. You're listening to The Main Course on the Heritage Radio Network. We have a very exciting new homepage that includes 6 or 7 news stories, which cycle out every day. So 6 new news stories every day, all about food, all 3 or 4 minutes long. Super, super fun. It's the type of website that you want to log on every morning now, every day, and see what's new. Food recalls. We just heard a piece earlier about all the turkey parts and why they're called what they're called and what they do and are they culinarily useful. Very, very interesting stuff. We're in studio with one of our favorite people and our first evolutionary on the Heritage Radio Network, Steve Jenkins. We've been talking about stores for cooks and ingredients and olive oil. But we wanted to, you know, when we told the interns that Steve was coming in, we have a few different questions that we accumulated. So top 3 food writers or food people over the past 30 years, besides you and me.
Oh, that's easy. I'll leave 4 or 5 out, but it's Patience Gray.
Patience Gray. Interesting. Tell us about
Patience.
She wrote
Honey from a Weed, which is probably my cardinal book in my library, and my library is immense.
Okay.
I don't know if it's in print anymore, but you can go online probably to Abe Books and find it. But anybody who is even mildly serious about food, if they want to bliss out, they'll get their hands on their own copy of Honey from a Weed by Patience Gray.
Okay.
Then I would say Roy Andries de Groot.
Hmm.
His book, Auberge of the Flowering Hearth, is one of the greatest books ever written.
Hmm.
He goes to visit Dauphiné, which is where the mountains resulted in chartreuse, the liqueur, are. And he finds his way up this mountain and runs into an auberge, an inn run by 3 old ladies who would do a composed menu every night for their inn that is just the most amazing thing. So the Auberge of the Flowering Hearth by Roy Andries de Groot. And after that, I'd say anything that M.F.K. Fisher, Mary Frances Fisher, wrote. M.F.K. Fisher is an American treasure. She transcends the notion of food writing way, way, way.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my 3.
Those are
right
your 3. Very interesting. And what about chefs? Not as food writers, but I mean people, or just, you know, distributor people who have really made a change in the way Americans see food. Like I say, not including you or me, because I know we would be
top, way up in there.
But I mean, is there a chef that you came along at a certain time, you know, that just changed things for you, or that it was just so superior to everybody else? You know,
I have the distinction of having gotten to wait on Craig Claiborne and Pierre Frenet for years. And that's a really, really wonderful thing that I think one of my arrows in my quiver, that I can actually say I knew those guys and talked to them. And I think the things that Craig did with Pierre were landmark. I think they brought us ahead decades in a matter of time, very short period of time. So they stick out in my mind. Nobody else is really coming to mind because I've got so many pals that are chefs.
Sure, yeah, you don't want to just pick. Well, now we're just jumping around here. So now 502 is a law in Washington State for the legalization of marijuana. And I just wonder, do you think pot should be legalized in the United States, or you think it doesn't matter? Do you think quality would go up or down if it was?
It's hard for me to talk about it because I've been a pothead for 40 years, and I don't know if I should say anything at all. It'll just incriminate me. You know, my mood all these years has always been directly tied to my stash. The lower my stash, the more annoyed and irritable I am.
Ornery.
But when I've been holding, and you know, I've never gotten down to sticks and seeds in 40 years. When I'm holding, I'm happy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think about it and I go, I don't really have an opinion either way. I rue that anyone's in jail over pot.
Mm-hmm.
I am concerned that kids that are too young are getting high. That bothers me a great deal because I've got children. So I'm afraid to say anything because I'm usually wrong about that stuff.
I learned from Mike Edison, my co-writer for the Carnivore's Manifesto, the book that comes out in the spring, that Louis Armstrong wrote a song called Muggles. Yep. And that's what it was called, you know, wearing his muggles.
Exactly.
So now, tell us about, now you just did a piece for the Wall Street Journal about the telling room.
That was early last summer, I guess it was.
Okay.
A few months ago. I wrote a review for a book called The Telling Room. And it was written by this guy that wrote a book a couple of years ago about Albert Einstein's brain having been removed from his skull and kept by the Princeton guy that performed the autopsy on him. Hmm. And Michael, the author of the Telling Room, wrote this book called Driving Mr. Albert, where he finally convinced this old man at Princeton who was still in possession of Einstein's brain to take it back to an Einstein family member. It's all this time's gone by, and they still haven't – nobody's claimed Einstein's brain, so they drive cross-country with Einstein's brain. So this is the guy who wrote The Telling Room, which is about a cheese that only I and another guy in Ann Arbor sold back in the mid-70s. It was like a Manchego, though it was not. It was made in the same area. It was a hard sheep's cheese that was delivered of its rind and packed in good olive oil in a can. It was canned cheese. And it became a superstar in that every president, every prime minister, every foreign minister, every opera star like Pavarotti, everybody that was anybody in fashion or design had to have this Paramo de Guzman sheep's cheese. Paramo meaning a height, like a butte or a plateau.
Okay.
And Guzman, the name of the cheesemaker in Castile León, in a hideous part of Spain, windswept, no trees, cold like hell in the winter, hot like hell in the summer. Nothing ever goes on. People hang out in little stone huts and smoke and drink and lop off chunks of chorizo all day, all night, to get away from the heat or to get away from the cold. Mm-hmm. And this guy, not a young man, this guy was middle-aged, and he just realized one day that his grandmother had stopped making this cheese that made his family so happy. And he thought to himself, why don't I make this cheese? All I do is drive long-distance trucks. Why, I might as well make this cheese. And he started to make this cheese his grandmother used to make, perfected it because he is a maniac. The cheese became a superstar. He became a superstar. His best friend who was helping him run the company proceeds to steal the company from him. He loses everything. He descends into a very dark place where all day he plans and plots the torture and murder of his best friend who stole his business from him. Mm. And this American, Michael, wrote this book, The Telling Room. And I wrote the review of it for the Wall Street Journal. And it's the damnedest thing you ever read, like the book he wrote 2 years prior about Albert Einstein's brain.
Right.
Your listeners must think I'm out of my mind.
I know. I was like, connect the back, please.
But are you hip to this, The Telling Room, about a cheese in a can that drives a guy so crazy that he's obsessed with torturing his best friend to death? He's going to sit him down, tie him up, cut off pieces of his ear. Then,
well, I understand. I'm married to a cheesemonger, so I understand what exactly. Anne has asked me to collaborate on a few injuries, not a killing. She's from the Midwest. But very, very interesting. Well, people should pull that up, and we'll provide a link to it on the Wall Street Journal website. That must have been a fun review. Do you do op-eds and that?
Does that turn you on? I'm asked, but I'm telling you, if you're into a great book, this is a great book.
That's awesome.
It's a terrific book, The Telling Room, and it's all about cheese and food and the lore of Spain. I mean, I learned more about Spain in the footnotes of this book than I knew heretofore, and I go to Spain 3 times a year for years and years and years. I learned more about Spain than I thought I knew.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, definitely, The Telling Room. And now another question. You're going to be at the Y with Joshua Wesson in the next few days. Tell me about that. And who is Joshua Wesson, and what are you going to be talking about? How do people get tickets?
Joshua Wesson is my colleague for years and years and years. We've held forth and parsed innumerable cheeses and their accompaniments and wines and other alcoholic beverages that go with them, that we've married with them, at venues such as the National Geographic Society, the Smithsonian, the University of this, the University of that, And our favorite venue is the 92nd Street Y because it's our neighborhood, it's our crowd, it's our people, and they have a series of events all autumn and winter where learned people come in and talk. And so they figured, well, we got to have some food people. Who can we get? Well, let's get that crazy man Jenkins and Joshua Wesson, who's a master sommelier, and he's the most engaging and knowledgeable and funny and fun guy in the world to talk to about wine, because he makes you understand that there's so many things to know about what he does all day. You'd just love to sit at Joshua's feet and listen to him talk about wine.
And they're going to be passing around cheese and wine?
Oh, it'll be composed. We'll have tables. Mm. And I'll compose a plate with 6-7 cheeses on it.
Oh, wow.
2-3 accompaniments, and Joshua will bring 6 or 7 wines. Yeah. I just found out, as I have done twice in the past, I served wild boar prosciutto at the Y once, and then the next year I served Iberico ham. This is before it was legal here, and I didn't realize that ham is not a big thing at the Y. Yeah, and they were horrified, absolutely horrified. And I'm getting so senile that I almost did it again this year. I had a cortador all set up to slice Iberico bellota at this gig, and another slicer, a salumiere, to slice my new brand of prosciutto called Zuarina, which I have to tell you about.
Zuarina,
harkens back to the Libyan days of Italy, which is nothing to be proud of. But this cheese has a heritage that goes all the way back to the turn of the century when Libya was involved in their colonial aspirations in Libya.
Italy never conquered very powerful places. Libya, Ethiopia, Eritrea, right? It's still called Eritrea a little bit.
Fascinating. Just fascinating. So that's December 8th at the 92nd Street Y. I don't know if it's sold out.
Okay.
I hope you'll call the box office and find out.
Yeah.
Because I'm not bragging. There's just nothing more fun than doing 3 hours of drinking wine and eating cheeses that turn me on and listening to everything there is to know about them.
Especially from you two guys.
Oh, well, yeah. And everybody gets bombed and it's egalitarian. Everybody asks questions. And it's just that there's no more fun. You can't have more fun.
So, you know, last question. We're already over on the show, but we always go over when you're on. biggest BS. Debunk something new for us, because I know you've never been afraid to debunk stuff, which I'm a great admirer of, because too many people sit back and let bullshit happen and they don't stand up to it. So I remember you once with the Sacramento Olive Oil Board, but you know, it's something that you do with great wit and fun. So anything new that pisses you off that people think but they're wrong?
I want people to remember that the beluga, the Ocetra, and the Sevruga species of sturgeon are as good as extinct. And do not allow yourself to be fed or yourself to purchase Iranian or Russian caviar ever, ever again. And if you think you're going to scratch that itch with American paddlefish, shovel nose, or hackleback, don't. It's serviceable caviar, and it is indeed from a species of sturgeon, and it's wild caught and wild seined. But it can't hold a candle in terms of snap and flavor and depth of flavor and lingering flavor that great Iranian and Russian Caspian caviar has.
So what I want you to do is
put caviar out of your mind. It doesn't exist anymore. Hmm. If you have to buy caviar, at least strive to get the American hackleback or paddlefish.
But it's not
going to delight you the way Caspian caviar used to.
What about truffles in Oregon? I mean, I know pigs that refuse to hunt them. I mean, are they have people made strides?
I have yet to taste serious truffles from this country, and I've tasted quite a few. I was with my friend Ariane Degan last week, who owns D'Artagnan, and I wanted to see what she had, and she showed me her black Burgundians that were gorgeous and beyond redolent, and she showed me her Alba Piemonte whites that were equally gorgeous, but they're $1,900 a pound, the whites, wholesale. So I would say to you, anybody that can afford that kind of thing for their gratification or their self-gratification, which are two different things, I think you should be firebombed for conspicuous consumerism, much the same as you should be for consuming caviar. So I think the whole thing is a big bunch of nonsense. Nothing I like more than white truffles with scrambled eggs. I can live without it because it makes me ill to think that anybody would spend that kind of money on food when they could make that money work someplace else. Who am I to say such a thing? What a hypocrite.
I know, two things in a row now. But I'm telling you,
I'm admitting to being a hypocrite, Patrick. But I would also say to you that truffle oil is among the most noisome.
Oh, yeah.
Substances there is.
You can smell it from across a dining room. That's not a natural substance.
I think it's gross, and I think it's uncool, and I hope our listeners will try and avoid anything imbued with truffle oil. Yes.
Because if you put a truffle in oil, the oil will not acquire any of that flavor. You really have to inject it.
That's why almost all the truffle oils that are available out there are phony, and they've got chemicals in them. I just private labeled our Fairway truffle oil, which is truly from real truffles. And it's oil that's been steeped with the truffles the old-fashioned way. But I loathe truffle oil.
Well, good. Well, there you go. There are three things for people, and I like it. You've made me really feel good. I'm not going to buy an $1,800 truffle. I'm not going to buy caviar. You've convinced me. I'll have to change the menu for tonight. But thanks, Steve. You just saved me a lot of money.
It's great to be with you, Patrick.
Yes, Steve. You're always a pleasure, and you'll be on. This is my 197th episode.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so I want to get first to 200, and then I'll let all these other dummies with their beer shows and cooking tips catch up and beat me. But first to 200 is legit, and you've been on more than anyone. It's always a pleasure, and I look forward to having you on many times in the future.
We'll get Joshua Wesson out here. You'll love him.
Oh, that'd be fun. We'll do a tasting. Great. Well, thanks everybody for listening. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, and stay tuned for What Doesn't Kill You, hosted by Katie Kiefer.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.